Welcome to the Flow Tracy Monday Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 3:32 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is March 31st, and it's Friday, so it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. It's also the end of the first quarter, and it's been a pretty positive return. So there's certainly been an incentive that if one were a money manager and you wanted to boost your returns before you have to issue a quarterly report, well, taking on some additional risk in the last week would probably have worked out, and we've certainly seen quite a bit of that. So the S&P 500 is firming from the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and this is where we're going to have a big argument. If we look at lots of back history, we can see plenty of examples where in a secular bull market, the market finds support in the region of that 1,000-day moving average during the occasional medium-term correction. And in between those medium-term corrections, we get really substantial advances. And they're beautifully rhythmic and they last for about a year or two. And then we get another big and medium-term correction. And that's generally how secular trends unfold. So then it begs the question, isn't that exactly what we've seen? We've had a really significant move on the upside between 2020 and 2021, and it lasted for about 2 years. The move up from the lows in early 2016 to early 2018 was also about 2 years, and then the big move up higher from about 2012 through to 2014 was a bit longer than 2 years. So what's really different about this trend? Isn't it still consistent? Well, there are a couple of things. Certainly, we've had bounces from the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and that is positive action. But the acceleration is a trend ending. We've had ample evidence over the years that accelerations are trend endings because they siphon money and buying power demand from the future and pour it into the present. And then you're bereft of potential buyers in the future as a result. And that's basically what happens during an acceleration. And I think of that very similarly to how things evolved in the late 1990s, where you had this enormous move on the upside from the Nasdaq. You had then the Y2K hysteria, massive spending on new infrastructure for networks. And then by the time we got around to early 2000, we had this massive acceleration, very high valuations, and a central bank that was worried about overheating and was cutting int or raising interest rates. The other most important point here is that when we look at these troughs in 2016, 2018, and 2020, and now again in 2022, and compare them then to the performance of the yield curve spread. And this is a graphic representation of what we might say is liquidity. So we can look at the historic peak of the spread in the early part of 2010. We had a peak in 2013. We had a peak in 2016. And we had an inversion in 2019. So that was almost the example that proved the rule, the exception that proved the rule, because it didn't look like there was going to be a recession, but we'd had exceptionally high valuations in private assets. But then the pandemic hit, that was your recession, but it was viewed as an exogenous shock and unrelated. But now we have this very deep over a really deep inversion of the yield curve. And conditions are about as tight as they were in the early 1980s, and they're just beginning to rise. So it's negative 56 basis points right now, but only 2 weeks ago it was negative 87 basis points. Now let's just pay attention to the fact that this is an inversion That was a mild inversion, but at no point prior to that, during the big bull market, had we had inversions. The hallmark of an inverted yield curve is that it gives a long and variable lead indicator for a future recession. And the lead indicator can be anything from 6 to 18 months. So it became first inverted in February of last year, fully inverted in June of last year. So any way you cut it, we're at least 12 months into this period. But then it's worth also reminding ourselves that during the period when the yield curve is continuing to invert, that has generally been consistent with really quite strong markets between 2005 and at the middle of 2007. The stock market continued to rise. Then we also had the initial inversion in 1998 and a brief flurry on the upside. Then it became further inverted. By the time it started trending higher, it was March of 2000 when the market actually rolled over. And I think this is very relevant because we continue to see that the Nasdaq is very firm. So we have this interesting environment where the Nasdaq has broken on the upside and we're right at the end of the quarter. Now, if this strength persists into next week, well, I'm going to be forced to take the loss on short positions. But I have a feeling that this enthusiasm is reasonably short-lived. When we think about what drove it higher in here today, it was the PCE deflator. So, on a year-over-year basis, it dropped down to 5%, and the prior value was about 5.4%. So, I think that's rather interesting because when we look at this on a weekly basis, well, we can see that it is definitely coming down, but and the pace of the decline is picking up. So that's helping to support the outlook for long-dated bonds. But what it's also helping to highlight is that the job of cutting interest rate, excuse me, of raising interest rates was almost exclusively aimed at getting inflation under control. And it's working. So 10-year yields are rolling over and doing so from the region of 3.5%. This is, I think, looks very toppy. There's the clear potential that yields are going to at least come back down to test the 1,000-day moving average, and that could compress yields by another 100 basis points at least. But that also implies that there's going to be economic stress. Well, one thing that's been in the headlines this week has been that the spreads on some of the more levered portions of the bond market are rising. So this is the investment grade portion of the commercial mortgage-backed securities market. And the spread is up now to 6.73%, 673 basis points. Before the financial crisis, it was normal to have spreads of about 225. So they're already significantly above that and approaching the highs from back in 2020. So I think this is also a clear sign that the liquidity issues that led to several banks going bust and the forced merger of Credit Suisse and UBS. These are a direct response to the raising interest rate environment, the fact that money supply growth is negative, and that we have inverted yield curves. Because basically, banks are liquidity providers. When they have a steep yield curve, then they can make money easily. When they have an inverted yield curve, it's more difficult to make money, given the ramping higher of the 10-year yield and and just about any kind of interest rate in the US over the last year, then lots of banks are sitting on fat losses. And I think this is something that's going to weigh on potential for a while yet. Now, these two charts, I think, are also very interesting. So we know that lots of high yield companies that they use the pandemic to borrow and to stretch their maturities. But there are lots of other companies didn't. And there's about 150 to 200 billion needs to be refinanced every month between March of 23 all the way out to the end of 2025. Then, excuse me, when we look at the commercial mortgage maturities, there's over 700 billion matures in 2023. And a lot of those loans tend to be floating rate. So the cost of servicing that debt has jumped significantly over the last year. And even to the extent that that debt is a fixed rate, it's still going to refinance into substantially higher levels. So these are issues that aren't just going to go away. But of course, what it also contributes to is speculation that interest rates are going to start to fall. So when we look at the 3-month yield, it ramped higher over the last year, still hovering here around the 4.7% level. Investors don't appear willing quite yet to give the benefit of the doubt to compression, and they seem to be willing to do exactly what they've been doing for the last year, which is not to make any kind of repricing until it is right ahead of the Fed funds meeting. And the next one of those isn't going to be until the beginning of June. Now, then we have the big question, because there are massive unfunded liabilities, and Social Security and Medicare/Medicaid are deemed to be untouchable from the perspective of politicians and how they manage the budget. So that then throws a lot of attention onto other portions of the budget. And of course, the defense sector is a big part of that. There's a lot of grumbling going on among Republicans about the cost of supporting Ukraine. I think there might be grumbling, but I can't see it changing. And it's a lot cheaper to support the Ukrainian army than to send a large number of troops over there. But what that also means is trying to negotiate a change in how the US government is funding itself is going to be very difficult. And I think that the dollar is beginning to price in that potential, that ultimately we're going to have a significant drawdown in the dollar. And I think it's most particularly relevant to just be aware of the fact that the dollar has an almost biblical trending environment, that it goes up for 7 years and down for 7 years, and in between those times, it does a fair share of ranging. So the current move on the upside peaked in 2021, well, in 2022, I should say, and that was a bit longer than normal, and the considerable strength in the dollar was all about trying to get inflation under control, trying to create a sense of confidence in the management of the still the reserve currency. What is now happening is the dollar is trending lower. So if the 7-year cycle is still intact, we can anticipate that the dollar will trend downwards until about 2029 or 2030, and then subsequently move into a rangy pattern for a few years and then rebound. But between now and then, that would potentially result in the dollar index going down to a new low. So that would take out the lows put in 2008, and we could see at about 30% taken off of the value of the currency. What that would suggest then is that within the USA there will be issues about inflation. There will be issues about trying to fund the deficits. There will be difficulties within the banking sector because they're sitting on these bonds and they're unable to sell them. So the leverage in the system is going to be reduced. And without leverage, it's very difficult to get a big bull market going. But what it also means is that the export sector would see their repatriated profits improving in value, and then the ex-US markets, particularly those that have been borrowing in dollars, then they're going to find that their situation is markedly improved. So the what happens in terms of the dollar is going to shape what happens in just about every other market. It's going to be very heavily influenced as well by what happens in terms of bonds. I remain of the view that bond yields are likely to fall by about 100 basis points, but then because of the weakness of the dollar, it's going to be difficult to justify a major contraction because the US will be curtailed in how aggressive they can be in cutting interest rates. It's unlikely they'll go back down to zero. It's unlikely we'll have a new fiscal stimulus akin to sending money to people in the post. And that doesn't mean that there won't be a fiscal stimulus. There will be a fiscal stimulus, there will be cutting interest rates, and there will be more money printed. But because of the unfunded liabilities, because of the threat of inflation, then the ability to continue to print willy-nilly is going to be heavily impacted. And that is the only way to support the currency, to stabilize the bond market, and ensure that there is a ready market for buying those treasuries when the currency is not in one's favor. So we're definitely seeing more interest flowing towards Europe, and the Euro Stoxx index has rebounded very emphatically from the region of the 200-day moving average. Now the FTSE 100 is a very internationally oriented market, and it's also rebounding, just not quite as impressively, but it does look like it's going to go higher from here. And then currencies, relative to the US dollar, are improving. So the pound is coming up to the upper side of this range that's been forming for the last 5 months and stable over the course of the last few days. But with the failed break below 120, the more likely scenario is that it's going to trade back up to the upper side of the range, which could take it up as high as 140. Then Latin American currencies really underperformed over the last decade, but the Brazilian real was stronger in a dynamic manner in here today. So this is the dollar breaking down against it, that blue candle right at the end of the chart. And the Mexican peso has also been strengthening, and it bounced from the region of the 200-day moving average last week and followed through on the upside this week. And it is testing the 18 level, and it hasn't strengthened through 18 for any kind of sustained period since about 2016. So there is a good reason why Mexico is outperforming, and it's because it's going to be one of the primary beneficiaries of near shoring. Now, what I found interesting today was that Brazil and China have signed a currency exchange agreement so that when they trade with one another, they're going to ensure that they pay in each other's currencies. And I think this is a really significant development. It suggests that the SWIFT system is really going to come under stress. and that there will be two competing systems, and China will have its own version. And what they want to do is settle in renminbi for the imports that they're making from Brazil. Of course, most of the things they import from Brazil are commodities. So that stretches from industrial resources to agriculture to energy. And what it also means is that there's a trusting relationship between these two parties. One of the primary reasons why everybody uses the dollar and the SWIFT messaging system is because the USA has protected the system and ensured that it hasn't been used to any one party's benefit, other than the US, for example. But now, with the war in Ukraine, the seizure of sovereign assets, and then also cutting out banks from using the SWIFT system, then that has weighed heavily on confidence. So now you have countries that are signing these side agreements. Now, obviously, Russia signing an agreement to transact in their respective currencies with Iran is something that doesn't make a lot of headlines. And what we're seeing now in this relationship between Brazil and China is a more serious event. But then you have the next question, which is, what would happen if Saudi Arabia were to start accepting renminbi for its oil? So the Tadawul index is bouncing now from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And denominating oil in dollars is a centerpiece of the argument for why the USA is a reserve currency. And this question then about Saudi Arabia and what they intend to do. Obviously, China would love to pay in their own currency. Europe had a handy solution that they could pay Russia in euro for oil, and now there is a war going on, which basically ended that. Mohammed bin Salman is exceptionally progressive, and he's attempting to build an economy, create jobs for millions of young people, and easing up on social mores. And these are incredible moves that he's making. But I think all of that is being tolerated. If, on the other hand, he were to start accepting renminbi for oil, then that really would be a step that the USA would not take kindly. So I think that there are very significant geopolitical issues that arise as a result of the weaker dollar. If the dollar continues to trend lower, well, one of the reasons why there was an oil embargo in the first place was because they were devaluing the currency. And it wouldn't be at all unlikely that if the dollar loses its value in an accelerated manner, then Saudi Arabia could easily change the currency that it is willing to accept for its products to that of its largest customer. And of course, that would also mean they would have less demand for US bonds. So I think that there is clear potential that we will have a reversion to the mean, the long secular trend mean for the treasury market. But I do not anticipate it's going to go much more than that. I think that we have seen a change of trend overall. What this also says to me is that we've had a meaningful rebound on Wall Street, and the total return on the 10-year yield has now broken above its 200-day moving average. So this is certainly highlighting the scope for a further reversion. And when we look at what the bullish story is, well, I think there are two strands to that bullish story. The first is that NVIDIA is very well placed to benefit from the build-out of artificial intelligence infrastructure. And the share has continued to rebound, and it's not far off tripling from or doubling. Excuse, well, putting it at 200% advance, let's be accurate, since the low in October of this year. And you have some of the most noted technology bigwigs talking about the need to slow down the rollout of artificial intelligence. But there's certainly an argument that it is a major labor-saving device. Of course, by saying labor-saving, it also would suggest that there is the potential for inflation to be moderated by unemployment rising significantly as a result of the knock-on effects of artificial intelligence and macros basically taking over a lot of functions of people. And of course, technology historically has been deflationary. So that's certainly one of the strands that would support the bullish outcome for the markets. The other is at China's reopening, and the luxury goods sector is a good way of thinking about that. So Hermès International continues to trend higher, broke out to new all-time highs in here today. Now, I don't think there's any other way to talk about this other than as an acceleration, and at the pace of the advance continues. It's always been in an expensive stock, and it's very closely held. So there's not a lot of additional supply to short, but it is certainly still accelerating higher. And traffic in or foot traffic in Macau is improving. So that suggests that the Chinese consumer is spending once more. So that's likely to be beneficial for the global economy as well. But the other point is that if we look at the equal weighted portion of this market, so if we instead of looking at absolute performance, the equal weighted index was in positive territory this week, but it is not pushing on to new high ground. And the number of shares that are trading above their 200-day moving average is now around 44%. About 2 months ago, it was a lot closer to 70%. So we've had a significant drawdown for a good portion of the market, but at least it is steadying right now. But one thing that I think is most particularly worth paying attention to right now is at the advanced decline line for the NYSE. So it rebounded and has subsequently started to roll over. Now, if I put this up instead of on a monthly chart, on a weekly chart, then it has steadied and it is right in the region of the 200-day moving average. But one of the hallmarks of a secular bear market is when the advanced decline line trends down through the 1,000-day moving average. So it's exceptionally important that support continue to hold and that we subsequently see that this area around the 1,000-day moving average is not penetrated. But we still have inverted yield curves, and we still have inflationary pressures. So we're at the point right now where the pause is likely, and it is likely that the Federal Reserve will pause and maybe wait and see. But if inflationary pressures rebound, then there is obviously the potential that they will not be able to cut rates as aggressively, and that will lead to a recession. And then what you have is instead of an inflationary boom, which is what we have right now, then we could potentially get an inflationary bust. Now, oil prices have rebounded quite emphatically, over the last 2 weeks and are testing the region of the $80. That's the lower side of the overhead trading range. Now, the price has been trending downwards for about a year already, and we have a succession of ranges, one below the last, and resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average on repeated occasions. So, if this is the low, then the price will push up through that $80 area. It'll push up into the overhead trading range. It could easily then take out a midpoint danger line stop and then improve again through the 200-day moving average. It'll have to do all of that in order to break the downtrend. So I think that's certainly something that is potentially possible, but it's going to require a significant hit to supply and for demand to rebound. And that might happen in the short term, but the tightening liquidity conditions we have around the world are something that certainly need to be paid attention to. But then, something that is a mitigating factor is the weakness of the dollar. And this redenominated chart of the central bank balance sheets of all the major economies redenominated into dollars helps to highlight that even though they're still raising rates and reducing money supply overall, that the weakness of the dollar is a really significant factor. So the total assets of central banks bottomed in September, October, right around the same time as the wider market, and then it rebounded. But we're not at a new recovery high. And what this tells me, at least, is that we've had some additional liquidity coming into the market, and the size of the Fed's balance sheet, for example, unwound about half of quantitative tightening in response to the bankruptcy of three regional banks 2 weeks ago. But it hasn't continued to, or the money supply has not continued to increase. But we can also see then that the index is above the 200-day moving average. So we're at a critical juncture here. And I think that the most important point is that the risky portions of the bond market are under pressure. And the yield curve spread is negative. And these are important factors, which would very much imply that there will be a recession. And the counter argument to that is that this time is different because we had the pandemic, we had the experiment with modern monetary theory, and therefore you can't apply the same lessons as one learned over past cycles. And my argument, our counter argument to that is that those same arguments have been used, that this time is different on every other occasion when there's been an inverted yield curve. And energy prices remain high by historical standards. The other point is that when we think about what's likely over the course of the next decade, I think inefficiency is probably going to trend more than efficiency. So for the moment, at least, everyone wants to focus on artificial intelligence. And that's certainly the topic that has really gained most attention from investors. But then, what about the fact that there is a significant trend towards pricing carbon emissions? So, carbon emissions rebounded this week from the region of the 200-day moving average. And what we've seen on repeated occasions is that these are government-sponsored instruments. When they pull back, the supply is restricted in order to support prices. And particularly European politicians, they're very eager to have high carbon emission prices so that they can encourage companies and consumers to use other things. But that is inefficient. When one uses intermittent electricity generation versus on-demand electricity generation, that is inherently inefficient. Then you have what's called load shedding. So when you have a high volume of electricity that's coming through from these renewable energy sources, the network can only absorb as only absorb so much, which means that you then get load shedding, and the grid is incapable of taking that electricity, so it doesn't feed through. Then there was a study announced this week from Stanford University saying that people are charging their cars at the wrong time. That most people charge their car when they get home and they're charging it all night. And if everybody did that, well, then they're not benefiting from solar energy. So that's obviously problematic because the generating capacity for electricity isn't rising nearly quickly enough to meet the goals of the energy sector and the renewable energy sector. So we need massive investment in power lines and massive investment in battery technology, because the only way to manage that flow is to ensure backup power so that when load shedding is necessary, the power gets stored. And when we think then about some of the battery companies, well, GWH is or ESS Corp, I think is the name, is one of those companies that produces batteries for our industrial purposes, and the share has been trending downwards now for nearly 2 years. And one of the biggest problems is the what they basically rely on is their intellectual property. And the problem with these batteries is that the technology is well understood. Now, Fluence is a better capitalized company, and they also produce batteries. And it's an offshoot from Siemens and AES Corp. So that's a joint venture that's been around a while. But they're also producing lithium-ion batteries. And at least it is more ranging and bouncing from the lower side of the range than trending downwards. Then you also have companies that are trying to benefit from the high cost of carbon. So ACRE, carbon capture, pulled back fairly sharply over the last 3 weeks, but now it's steadying again. And this is a company that is producing carbon, or producing technology to capture carbon from industrial processes. And their big, I guess their bullish potential is that they can break into the US market or find a US partner. But so far, they're in Norway and in the UK and in several European countries. So there's certainly the scope for more investment in renewable energy, and the solar sector is bouncing from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. The size of wind turbines continues to get bigger because of the economies of scale. So it is also starting to firm now from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. The Brookfield Renewable Partners ETF, or excuse me, fund, is also steadying now and bouncing up through both the 1,000-day and the 200-day moving averages. So there's certainly a willingness among the new technology and broader technology sectors to bet that we're at the peak of the interest rate hiking cycle. Now, generally speaking, the first interest rate cut is bad news for stock markets. So what investors are also betting is not only are we at the peak of the interest rate hiking cycle, but that a recession will be avoided and that the issues that we have in the bank sector are going to be sufficiently large to encourage central banks around the world to continue to boost the supply of new cash, and that we're going to go back into the massively liquidity-fueled environment that we had for the last 12 years. And it's possible. And we can give the benefit of the doubt to the most recent dynamic. But we have to be aware of the fact that when all of these issues in the credit markets, and when they start to really bite, and Brookfield Corp is also rebounding. So we've definitely seen some of the risk-off environment ebbing as we come to the end of the quarter. Now, the bigger questions about interest rates and about availability of credit, they remain unanswered. But the stock market is willing to bet that everything is going to be, we're going to have a Goldilocks scenario, whereas the bond market is pricing in the potential that there could be as many as three interest rate cuts by the end of this year. And that also suggests that we're not going to have a benign economic outcome. And usually the credit market leads the stock market. And we're not getting that right now. So one of them has to be wrong. And then I think we are in this interesting environment where we have geopolitical tensions and we have hysteria about the climate and a clear desire to migrate into the renewable energy future. So what I find especially interesting is that even though oil prices have been trending down, copper has been trending higher, and it bounced really impressively this week from the region of the 200-day moving average. To the extent that just about all of the regulations about renewable energy imply that oil will no longer be used, every one of the solutions relies on availability of copper, and there is not sufficient mined copper available to meet the demand. And then the only way that that could possibly occur was if the Chinese economy collapsed. But China is supporting their domestic housing market. They're trying to delever, but they're not willing to delever immediately. They're trying to deflate their housing bubble slowly. They're also trying to support the value of their bonds. They're trying to support the value of their currency because China wants to be viewed as a trusted partner on the international stage. And that is, I think, also one of the very big questions. To what extent is the USA willing to tolerate pain in service to supporting the dollar? I really believe that we're going to have the answer to that within the next 3 months, but history would suggest that this is a pivotal time for gold, and it's right in the region of the upper side of this range. I sold out of my leveraged long positions, and I was anticipating a somewhat deeper pullback. That has not happened, or at least it hasn't happened yet. And I think that in the event that the dollar does trend downwards for the rest of the decade, there is the clear scope that gold will trend higher and that we will see a multiplication factor in terms of pricing. And then silver is right in the region of its succession of lower rally highs and testing those levels right now. If it sustains a move up through $25, well, then that will break the 2-year downtrend. And then it's really only a double to get back to the peak from 2011. But what I think is much more likely on this occasion is that we're going to see gold breaking out to new all-time highs on a purchasing power parity basis. And that would then be a real confirmation of its store of value properties against a background of depreciating fiat currencies. Now, if commodities are going to remain firm, the dollar weak and gold firm, well, then emerging markets are going to also do particularly well. Now, the big question for many will be, do they want to have exposure to China, or do they want emerging markets ex-China? So there is an emerging markets ex-China ETF, and it has base formation characteristics, and it's coming up towards the upper side of this range. I think that there is a clear scope that Mexico is going to be one of the primary beneficiaries of a weakening dollar and reshoring, and the MSCI Mexico ETF is popping on the upside in here this week, and it has completed its base formation. The Brazilian ETF is bouncing from the lower side of a prolonged ranging phase, but with the currency appreciating, there is and the economy beginning to weaken, I think there is clear scope that Brazil, having been the first country to raise rates and do so aggressively, will be among those to be first to begin to cut rates. And I think that will be a template for what we can anticipate from other countries. And Brazil will probably lead the way in cutting interest rates. So I think that there is an order of operations that we're now at a point where the yield curve spread has probably gone down as much as it's going to go. And the 10-year minus the 3-month tends to be much more sensitive. So, and that was at a new all-time low this week. Or excuse, well, not all-time low. That's a misrepresentation. But it's certainly at the lowest level in decades in here this week. So this is also confirmation of why stocks are still firm. It is quite normal for the stock market to rally during the inversion phase. It's when we start to see the inversion reversing and trending up through zero. That's when the biggest risk of selling pressure arrives in the stock market. That is also likely to correspond with interest rate cuts and a weakening dollar, which will then bolster the argument for emerging markets. So then the question for an investor today is whether one should just support the current bull market on technology and then have an initial position in emerging markets, because one can then sell out of the US market, increase positions in emerging markets and non-US assets when the yield curve spread starts to move higher. Still have cash on hand, because when you have the leash effect of Wall Street pulling back and difficulty in the US, that has a knock-on effect everywhere. But resisting then the temptation to jump back into the large cap technology shares and instead favor growth in the emerging markets will, I think, be the primary decision that will form the benefit over the next secular theme. We could easily be in for another decade of commodity market and emerging market outperformance relative to Wall Street. And of course, that would also correspond with a secular bear market where you get a generational long process of PE ratio contraction and rising dividend yields. And that would probably also correspond with a lengthier period of subpar growth in the USA, where a lot of the unfunded liabilities and issues with debt that have now been compounded within the banking sector are unwound over just a lengthy period of not doing much at all. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend. And I wish all the best to all of you.